Good evening and welcome to the December 2025 edition of Outbeat News in Depth. I'm Greg Moralia. Well, one of the hottest gay-themed TV shows this fall was the miniseries Boots. It was based on the true story of Greg Cope White about his time in the U.S. Marine Corps, as written in his book, The Pink Marine. We reported on Outbeat News how the Pentagon criticized this series and Netflix for, quote, feeding woke garbage to their audience and children. Well, Greg Cope White joins us tonight to talk more about this book, The Marines, and his story. So stay with us. It's all coming up next, right after your Outbeat Radio News for this Sunday, December 28th, 2025. This is Greg Moralia with your Outbeat Radio News for the week of December 28th, 2025. Well, calendar year 2025 has been a year filled with anti-transgender news in almost every Outbeat News segment we've produced, and this last segment of the year is no exception. It starts with a vote in the U.S. House on a bill that would make doctors and parents criminals for providing gender-affirming medical care to transgender minors, marking the first time Congress has approved a national ban on such treatment and escalating a years-long Republican campaign to regulate transgender lives through federal law. It now goes on to the Senate, where it is unlikely to pass. The legislation was introduced by Republican Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia, entitled the Protect Children's Innocence Act. It would impose felony penalties of up to 10 years in prison on physicians who provide puberty blockers, hormone therapy, or other surgical care to patients under the age of 18. The bill would expose parents and others who consent to or help minors access that care to criminal liability. The bill passed with 216 members of the House of Representatives voting for it and 211 against it. The majority vote included three Democrats from the state of Texas and North Carolina. After the bill passed, out California U.S. Representative Mark Tacano, chair of the Congressional Equality Caucus, criticized the passage of the bill and said, quote, "This bill is the most extreme anti-transgender legislation to ever pass through the House of Representatives, and it's a direct attack on the rights of parents to work with their children and their doctors to provide them with the medical care they need." As we've shared before, every major medical association in the United States, including the American Medical Association and the American Academy of Pediatrics, supports providing this evidence-based and safe care to young people when supervised by a qualified healthcare provider. And also this last week, Donald Trump's Food and Drug Administration sent a warning letter to nearly a dozen companies that sell chest binders, claiming that they have, quote, misbranded medical devices. The FDA sent the letters to 11 companies for not registering their products as Class 1 medical devices for the 2026 fiscal year. The companies have never been required to do so before, and three of them are not even located in the United States. In the letters, FDA Director Michael Hoffman claimed that, quote, "These products are devices because they are intended for the use in the diagnosis of a disease or other conditions, or in the cure, mitigation, treatment, or prevention of disease, or to affect the structure of any function of the body," end quote. Hoffman referenced the information from companies' websites that claim the products can alleviate gender dysphoria. Gender dysphoria, which is a specific type of stress that arises when one's gender identity does not match their sex assigned at birth, is classified as a medical condition. However, chest binders have no use beyond aesthetics. They only slightly flatten one's chest, and the effects disappear as soon as the binder is removed. Chest binders have never been before considered medical devices. They're frequently used for costumes in both theater and cosplay, being comparable to shapewear, compression clothing, or sports bras. The letters were sent as part of the Department of Health and Human Services' recent crackdown on gender-affirming care for youth. The agency announced at a press conference earlier this month that it is issuing proposals to ban the life-saving care for those under the age of 18 and to prevent both Medicaid and children's health insurance programs from covering such treatment. And here in California, a Sacramento man's family and the local LGBTQ plus community are still fighting for justice 6 weeks after a victim was rendered comatose during an attack that's been diagnosed as an anti-LGBTQ plus hate crime. Alvin Prasad, who is 57 years old, was leaving an LGBTQ plus club with his daughter and a friend last Halloween night when a man began shouting at them from his car. The victim turned around to ask why the suspect spoke to him that way, and the man allegedly punched him. The punch was directly to Prasad's forehead, which caused him to fall back and hit his head on the concrete sidewalk. He's been in a coma since, with permanent damage on both sides of his brain. Sean Wesley Payton, 24 years old, was arrested and booked into Sacramento's main jail back on November 17th on charges related to assault, hate crime, and resisting arrest. He pleaded not guilty in court and will remain in custody until his court trial in January. And finally, as this is the last Outbeat News segment of the year, we'd like to take a moment to thank our news partners, The Advocate Magazine, LGBTQ Nation, and The Bay Area Reporter. For Outbeat Radio News, I'm Greg Moralia. Well, let's begin tonight with Raif DeRazi and this month's HIV News Roundup.
As 2025 comes to a close, the global HIV story is defined by a stark contradiction. The science moved faster than ever, but many systems meant to deliver that science continued to fracture. This year brought real advances in prevention, treatment, and cure research, alongside rising deaths in parts of Europe, widening access gaps, and growing political pressure on HIV financing. What we learned in 2025 is that progress is no longer limited by what's possible in the lab, but by what societies choose to sustain. One of the most consequential revelations this year was the growing divergence in global HIV outcomes, most notably at EACTS, or the European AIDS Clinical Society Conference, confirmed that while many high-income countries have stabilized incidence, HIV-related deaths in Europe are now higher than they were 15 years ago, driven largely by Eastern Europe and neighboring regions. The drivers were consistent across reports. Late diagnoses that still have many entering care with advanced disease, ongoing injection drug use epidemics without sufficient harm reduction, conflict and political instability disrupting ART continuity, and chronic underinvestment in public health infrastructure. The lessons are uncomfortable but clear. HIV rebounds where systems collapse, regardless of how advanced the science becomes elsewhere. This year marked a turning point for HIV prevention, not because of a single breakthrough, but because of genuine diversification. Long-acting prevention took center stage, with twice-yearly injectable PrEP moving from trial headlines into early real-world rollout discussions, including initial deliveries in parts of Southern Africa. At the same time, weekly oral PrEP data presented at EACTS showed strong pharmacologic coverage and promising adherence, signaling a potential middle ground for people who want alternatives to daily pills or injections. Equally important were quieter but consequential access shifts, expansion of community-led PrEP models outperforming clinic-based delivery, policy updates explicitly including trans and non-binary communities in national PrEP programs, and increased emphasis on multiple-month prescription dispensing as prevention continuity, not convenience. In 2025, prevention progress came not from novelty alone, but from meeting people where they are, structurally and socially. On the treatment side, we reinforced how far antiretroviral therapy has come and how unevenly its benefits are distributed. Ultra-long-acting ART platforms showed sustained drug levels beyond 6 months, raising the prospect of annual dosing. Researchers also began confronting questions that had long been deferred: latent reservoir penetration, resistance management, and critically, pricing and access models before approval, not after. Meanwhile, countries investing in delivery systems such as expanded 6-month ART refills demonstrated that viral suppression gains are often driven more by logistics and policy than by pharmacology. The year underscored a recurring theme: treatment innovation without delivery planning deepens inequality. Cure science also advanced, not through hype, but through refinement. Next generation, quote, reactivate and kill, unquote, strategies moved beyond blunt latency reversal toward precision approaches. More selective reactivation agents paired with engineered immune tools like broadly neutralizing antibodies and CAR-T-based platforms. The emphasis shifted toward minimizing toxicity while maximizing immune-mediated clearance. What changed this year wasn't the promise of a cure, but the discipline of the field. Fewer grand claims, better mechanistic data, clearer acknowledgement of limits. In the United States, one reality became unmistakable. Biomedical capacity is no longer the primary vulnerability. Financing and political volatility are. even though temporary, disrupted CDC surveillance, delayed HRSA reimbursements, and strained Ryan White-funded clinics operating on narrow margins. At the same time, proposed structural changes to Medicaid eligibility, Affordable Care Act subsidies, and state cost sharing signaled growing instability for ADAP programs and insurance-based HIV care. The risk was not mass service collapse, but erosion, delayed care, administrative bottlenecks, and clinics forced to absorb uncertainty without buffer. The U.S. HIV landscape proved alarmingly fragile. Yet, even amid rising deaths in parts of Europe, tightening budgets, and growing political strain, 2025 clarified something essential. The future of HIV is no longer determined by scientific possibility alone. It is shaped by governance, financing, inclusion, and whether systems are designed to carry innovation all the way to the people who need it. This year didn't offer easy reassurance, but it did offer clarity. And clarity, when acted on, remains one of the most powerful tools public health has. Thank you for following this year-end HIV News Roundup, with plenty more to come in 2026. For continued coverage and analysis, you can follow me on YouTube at Raif Durazi.
Thanks, Raif. I'm so grateful you were able to join our team this year and look forward to hearing a whole lot more in the coming months. And I'm also grateful to have Finn Dearhart joining me this year as a co-host on Outbeat News in Depth. Hey, Finn, how's it going?
Well, considering all the things, I'm feeling really good. I'm feeling good this morning and alert and excited about connecting.
Excellent. Yeah, it's our last show of the year, and I can't think of a better way to go out than with this great guest tonight. Do you have any New Year's plans?
Avoid things.
You're going to stay inside.
I do like personal ritual. I don't really, I'm actually in a process of kind of divesting from a lot of our holidays in the West anyway, in the ways that we have celebrated them historically. Same thing around Christmas. Just doing something different. And around New Year's, I do the same thing. I like to go inward and just do some writing and be in a personal ritual space and then kind of see how it goes. But I take off a few days just to kind of be in that emotional world of my own.
Great. Great.
Lots of cooking, just laying low, contemplating, reflecting.
I am doing a lot of cooking for New Year's. Yeah. We have a couple of gathering of friends, small gatherings, and making some stuff for that, but that's always fun. And being off from school for a few weeks is a great time to recharge for me. So, but I am looking forward to going back. I'm ready to go back. I always find that I look forward to vacation, and then when winter break comes shortly into it, I'm ready to go back. So I guess that's a good sign. Well, hey, let's get to our guest tonight.
Yeah.
Well, The Pink Marine is Greg Cope White's moving memoir chronicling how a skinny gay teenager from New Orleans enlisted in the U.S. Marine Corps to prove that he could become a man and become one of the few and proud. This fall, Netflix premiered Boots, a miniseries based on this book, and it became widely popular, especially after Trump's Pentagon criticized it for being, quote, woke garbage. Well, I can tell you, having watched the entire series myself and thoroughly enjoying it, it was anything but that. With us tonight is the author of The Pink Marine, Greg Cope White. Hey, Greg, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you, Greg.
It's lovely to have you with us. And I'm so glad that Finn could join us at the same time as well to get to know you a little bit and hear about your personal story, but also talk about how that became just a great show on TV. But before we get to that, I'm curious.
I have to say thank you, because that's just, these are, I'm not going to, you know, this project has made me lead with nothing but gratitude. So I just wanted to acknowledge that first.
Great. I'm glad it was a great experience, because it was a great, great, great show. It is a great show. But I'm curious, where did you grow up and what was it like for you in your generation discovering you were gay?
I was born in Lubbock, Texas. If you freeze the birth certificate in the final episode of Boots, that's Lubbock, Texas. And just like Cameron, I am a Cancer moon with Aries rising, whatever. I'm born in Lubbock. And then just like Cameron, I moved around. I went to 13 different schools in 11 years. 10th grade, I was in three schools just for the 10th grade. So I didn't have a tether. And I didn't come from a really close family, a small family. And just kind of didn't have a great childhood, but I met a great guy in the ninth grade, and we became best friends, and just were inseparable for that 1 year that I was, we were at the same school. And then, of course, I went on to 17,000 other schools. But even before social media, we managed to stay in touch, and we're still best friends to this day. I think we just celebrated our 52nd year, best friends year.
Oh, wow.
He also lives here in Southern California. He's a surgeon. And he, you know, the whole idea of family, found family, I certainly didn't know what that was, but I certainly learned what it was from an early time. So that's the biggest blessing, is that I get to have a family through him. You know, I'm the godfather of his kids, and we still, you know, it's insane. We're still we talk every single day or see each other. So it's great. That foundation gave me an ally and someone to share what I was going through, and believe it or not, was so accepting and gracious about the whole thing, and like, no big deal. So that was kind of the confidence they had, which was really ironic, because then he, did you want to get in the story about how the whole book happened, the whole experience happened? He called one day after our freshman year of college, or junior college for me, and he'd been at the Air Force Academy, which is really strict and hard, and it should be. They're the leaders of our military, and his eyes had gone a little bit bad during training that first year, and he couldn't be a pilot anymore, and that was what he wanted out of the Air Force. And his father had been, as you see in the show, the character in the show is Ray. His father was the highest ranking Marine and wasn't exactly thrilled that his son was off to be a flyboy. So he called me and said, I'm going to resign from the military academy, from the Air Force Academy, and I'm going to finish my time in enlisted boot camp at Parris Island, South Carolina. And I heard summer and camp and said, I'll go with you. I love boots. And he said, no, you're crazy. You've never run a mile. You don't know anything about the military. They'll eat you alive. And, you know, I'm gay. It's illegal to be gay. So that was the first hurdle, was just convincing him to let me go along with him on this adventure. And you know what? He never said no. He never said, this is mine. This is not something for you. You're in a different world. He just, that's what I'm talking about, allyship. He never saw me as other, and certainly said, okay, if you're crazy enough to come with me to this little summer camp, well, let's go. And, you know, of course it was crazy. I didn't know anything about the military, just like he said. Mm-hmm. I'd never run a mile, just like he said. And I was gay. Those were all problems. And we, you know, but together we got through them day by day, and it was an experience. And that's enough of me talking. Maybe I shouldn't have had the whole half a cup of this coffee.
Well, I mean, you've already kind of veered to where I actually wanted to talk about. And I'm curious. So you knew about the laws at the time, and what I'm hearing you say is that it was the friendship that was the impetus to go.
It was.
What else at the time were you experiencing around this tension about being gay and knowing that you're entering into a space where that wouldn't be okay? And how did you make that okay inside?
You know, I was looking for what I was supposed to be. Mm-hmm. And because growing up when I was, I think, Greg, I think we're probably closer in age than I am to you, Finn. And you know, when I was coming up and I knew I was gay early on, we didn't even know if Elton John was. It was that different. There was rumors. Right. Mm-hmm. And he came out when it was safe for him to come out. So there's no rush, and don't anybody come out till it's safe to come out. But the point is, I just had no look at that I was going to be okay. I saw the way that gay people were portrayed in movies and television shows. And I thought, that's probably not a fit. I saw the hyper-masculine, the guys outside of, you know, a gay bar with the big bushy mustaches and the biker hats and everything. I thought, oh, probably couldn't pull that off. And I would search the library for books and references and things that said I'd be okay. And I literally just didn't know what kind of a life was ahead of me. So when he said, do you want to, or that I'm going to do this thing and you can do it with me, I honestly didn't think about anything except maybe being disliked or beaten up because someone found out he was gay. Mm-hmm. I really never worried about what the, maybe because I'd been to 13 schools in 11 years, they're really, I was kind of the king of news situations.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. This is so fascinating to me. And I'll just say this and kind of pass it on to the next question, but I'm thinking about how our culture prioritizes romantic love in such a way, but here's this, like, it's like what I'm hearing in it is a love story between you and the friend, and going into this space that also is taking you in a deeper process with yourself. It's really beautiful.
Thanks, Finn. And it was our mission in the writer's room was we are telling, a platonic love story that started with the character that's based on me and the character based on Dale. And then it expanded. What we were always excited about was this brotherhood that was formed, and where, you know, just like I was, Cameron was feeling alone and lonely and also didn't know what his place was. Yeah. You know, he also didn't have the happiest home life either. So we were running towards something that we didn't know what it was. And, you know, I didn't do it alone. And that's what the blessing, and I say it so many times, the blessing of allyship. There's just, right. It's just amazing to have someone in your corner. And sometimes that's your family. Sometimes it's your brother, your sister, your parents, a teacher, a coach, whoever that is. But, you know, it's just, I think, you know, it's interesting. A lot of gay people don't even enjoy having male relationships or you know, straight male relationships, because they're always afraid that they're going to want to just have sex with them or whatever. Mm-hmm. I'm here to tell you that it can exist the other way. One of the most meaningful things about this process was while I was on set working, Dale would come and come to visit set in New Orleans, which we were from, by the way, where we met. And it was just really cool for me to show the crew that was telling the story about this friendship that expands into many, many friendships, that core still existed, that it was there and that it was real. And he had a great time. And we do a cameo in episode 4, and then I do another one in the final episode. But it was just terrific having him there. And I think he came several times, and I think he left with pretty much every cast member's cell phone in his phone.
That's fun.
Which, he's a doctor. I'm sure they're having their own I have a headache conversations.
There's a few of those phone numbers that I want.
Well, you know, it's interesting because, you know, I come from a law enforcement background. I don't know if you knew that or I told you that, but I distinctly connected with your experience discovering the realities of Paris Island. When I was 15, I went down to a youth cadet academy, and it was at Camp Pendleton. And I had this vision that it was going to be this training program in a nice hotel, because that's what I had always heard about police training. And then when the green bus pulled up at the airport, I knew that something was very different. Oh my God. I went into those barracks, and very much like was portrayed in the show, when I saw that open bathroom and began to think about what it was going to be like for me that entire week I was there, with shower stalls on one wall, sinks on the other stall, and toilets with no dividers, no privacy on the other wall. Yeah. I panicked, as I've shared with Finn the story before, and called my mom and said, "Get me the hell out of here." But you couldn't
you
do that.
You needed to see a manager.
Yeah. What was that like for you getting off that bus?
Just like that, but I was, you know, the was your concern your sexuality or just your own privacy?
All of the above. Okay. I mean, I did spend one night there, and it was in a barracks very much like, you know, you portrayed in the film, in the TV show, with, I don't know, 100 kids my age. And so there was something, I guess, a bit exciting about that, but also terrifying at the same time.
Totally get it. You know, when with the I don't know how they organized it when you showed up, but the Marines have you arrive in the middle of the night, so you're disoriented, and you don't know where you are, because you've taken 1,000 turns down these weird dark roads, because it's in these marshy swamps of this island. And you know, pulling through, I spent a lot of time describing what it was like on that green bus. And, you know, the shock of pulling through armed gates and thinking, why are there guards here keeping, you know, what's happening? It's a military thing. And then it starts hitting you that you're in a different world. And, you know, the bus rolls up and the drill instructor comes on and screams and yells. And I didn't get off the bus. Typical to you, you know, similar to you calling your mom, I looked at Dale and I said, no, Dale, no one talks to me like that. And I lasted about, and he's like, what are you? He looked at me and goes, what are you doing? And I'm like, I'm not feeling it. That lasted about a split second. And that drill instructor got in my face. And I don't know if you've ever had a drill instructor in your face, but it is something that I wish everyone had that experience, just to have
and
it
why?
In your
why?
Why? I don't remember how I magically appeared from my bus seat onto those yellow footprints, but it was toot sweet, I can tell you that. And then it was just really weird because I had no idea any of this was going to happen. Suddenly my head was shaved. I spent a lot of time talking about that in the book because it was really funny, as well as, you know, that when Dale and I got busted, we rubbed each other's head. You see that in the show, because we just never seen each other bald. Yeah. And it feels like velvet, kind of. And we were rubbing each other's heads because we knew each other from, you know, and they, you know, called us F word and everything else and threw us out in the alley. And Dale's like, okay, look, this is what can't happen. And we started realizing that I had to lock it up, and it was going to be a struggle to basically to become a Marine. I had to unbecome myself and become a Marine, but it's not a total transformation. I still take the parts of me that I wanted. I guess it's kind of like, do we shop for our personality as we're growing up? Do we take from this experience and that experience and this experience and build that? And then that's what we present, maybe. But I definitely used, you know, humor. It was important to me. It's the basis of Dale and my relationship. And so, you know, to have him there, and it was hysterical. So when it came time to process it, to write the book about it, I took such a long time to write the book because I didn't know how to tell this story. You're in it. Boy, if I had told the story, just like I can imagine you did, Greg, that one night, that would have been one wild story. It would have been whiny and complaining and all this stuff and angry. And by stepping back for about 20 years, circling the desk, thinking, how am I going to do this? And then spending time, you know, I started writing television sitcoms. I wrote on two of Norman Lear's other sitcoms. And you know, honing that comedy writer voice, that's when I decided that I was ready to write the book. And then when stories of bullying young kids started coming on the news, and the kids were choosing to end their lives rather than hold on to the bully, I thought, no. I've been yelled at by the biggest bullies in the world. Let me tell that story, children, and put it on a shelf. And it's there in the library, just like I used to look for stuff in the library too. And, you know, just tell these, an example, just to hold on for one more day, because as we all know, we are stronger than the bully. And we just need to make sure that everybody understands that they matter.
Yeah, awesome.
This idea of locking something up is really sticking with me. And I'm going to look at this through the lens of a kind of parts of self way of thinking, but it's like, and actually, just as a pretext to this, I had watched the show with my partner, and his emotional reaction was like a grief about what was lost, he said, with the characters. And like, the, you know, Cope had to put away his sexuality. And when he makes that, you know, stands up to, well, I don't know if I want to tell plot for people who have not seen the show, but there's a moment where you really see him step into what he's become, right? What's been shaped in a way. And I know that there's something that was locked up there, and there was something also gained. And so I think about that in relationship to what you're saying. You said I locked it up, and then you're in this intense training and boot camp. And so there's also a lot of cultural narrative about the value of what a young man can quote unquote go through and what it can do for him to go through this kind of training. And I'm curious for you, in that same parts of self kind of way, like I locked something up, did I gain something? Was it something that you also would say was really valuable for you? And if so, what?
You know, it cut out a little bit. Is it something that was what to me? Viable?
Was there something of value that you would say that you learned there that it was also something that you gained, you know, at the same time that you were locking something up?
Completely. Then that's a really thoughtful question, by the way. Thank you. I appreciate that. I hadn't ever framed it that way. But I was pretty lost. I didn't know, like I said, where I was headed, where I was supposed to be. So I entered this weird world. I don't know anything about it. And I start figuring it out and doing like what everybody else is doing. You know, we're all there. We're equalized. We have a shaved head, exact same clothes. We're sleeping in the same room. We're showering together, all that stuff. We're training together. This is our only world. So we're kind of all on the same playing field, but we're responsible for our own training and what we're learning and getting better at. And I was made scribe early on in training, which was another responsibility. And while I didn't, you know, welcome more work than we already had, I realized that it was a chance to challenge myself and take this on and try to do a good job, because people were telling me for the first time in my life that I was good at something. So maybe, Finn, it's, I was operating off the reward system, like when you give a kid a M&M when they're potty training. But I was finding my footing, in essence, and I was you know, probably disrespected by some people and respected by others, but I'd never played that game before. So it was, again, I was gaining confidence and ironic that I couldn't be my authentic self, but still try to operate from a place of willingness to take on the challenges and try it, because I really didn't have a choice. You're kind of locked in. So
totally.
But I did choose to, you know, to do everything I could on a daily basis to hide my sexuality and make sure that I wasn't found out, because I didn't want to leave this. I didn't want to get kicked out. I didn't want to be told that they were right. I couldn't do it. And, you know, I really wanted to stick it out. And I also didn't want to let my best friend down.
Sure. And see, that to me, that's so, I really appreciate hearing that. There's so many vectors that are being experienced there, because, you know, in our culture now, we would maybe prioritize a sense of like, well, the sexual identity, I didn't get to live into that aspect, but you're living into other aspects of yourself that were also part of who you are and being shaped by that experience.
Yeah, maybe, you know, for lack of a better thought, it was maybe I put it on ice for a couple of months and, you know, thought, okay, we do compartmentalize things all the time, right? I'll worry about that later. It's really why I believe that everyone should serve in the military, because that's not what I led with every day. I led with my challenge and my task and the job that was in front of me, and the job, and no part of my job description was look for a boyfriend. So I didn't.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting.
Yeah, thank you.
You know, I ran the police academy over in Napa for about 10 years and been teaching, well, was teaching in that program almost the entire time it existed, about 39 years. And we adopted the Marine Corps model as sort of our structure for that paramilitary way of teaching. And there is a point of teaching that takes place there. And I do think that there is some value that can come from that. And we've had students who were gay in the academy and either came out later on, and a couple came out actually during the academy, but that was a very different time. You had not only the culture of the military to deal with, but also the legal aspects of it that made it very risky for getting a discharge.
True. And you know, just, you know, it's a scar. And,
sure.
And my friends that I'm getting on the phone at noon today with one of our military advisors for the show, who was kicked out under Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And just in case anybody is a veteran and wants to explore screenwriting, just a little PSA, the Writers Guild has a program called the Veterans Writing Project. And you work with working mentors. I've been working with the project for a long time. And you work with working writers and you mentor. And by the end of the year-long mentorship, you have a script out that you can pitch. And so it's a great program. It's the longest mentorship program left in Hollywood, and it's open to any military veterans.
Fantastic.
And, even if you're writing with a partner or something. And the applications are on the Writers Guild Foundation website. But it's a really good resource. Anyway, you know, the fact that we didn't want to have that on a record, we didn't want to lose this, Greg, is I think the same thing that was important to everybody. You don't even want to get kicked out of the police academy because you're not doing a good job. I mean, you just don't want to get kicked out. Doesn't matter if you're kicked out for your sexuality or whatever. You're there because you believe you can do it and want to do it. So we'd never want those jobs to end.
Yeah, and have those dreams taken away. I want to shift a little bit and talk more about the book and then also how it became a TV series. You said that it took about 20 years of thought until the book was created. How did it get to be a miniseries on Netflix?
You know, I first had to learn how to write a book. I'd only written scripts, and it's a, you know, as you know, it's a different animal. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons I hesitated for so long to write the story was also because I didn't know how to write a book. So my boyfriend, this is 17 years ago, said, show me your phone. And he said, there's 80 pictures of pie on here. Write me a short story about pie or food. So I didn't know what he was talking about. So I went and I pounded out a little story, and it was a story about dropping the Christmas trifle, as I'd been told I was going to drop the Christmas trifle 100 times until I finally did just drop the trifle. And he said, now write me another one. And I did. And he, about 2 days later, he built this blog. And he said, I'm going to build this blog and you're going to load stories to it. And he was right. And I built my long form narrative muscles that way. And along that way, Huffington Post picked it up and they knew that I was working on a book and they were excited to support that. And then Food Network found it and that was lovely. And I shot a pilot for them and hosted the show. So I was building my author platform, which is important. So that helped. That was a step towards getting it to a bigger audience. Hmm. And then my agent sold it to a publisher and I was excited. He was not the right publisher for me. He was unfortunately struggling, and the book was out about a month, and I unfortunately suffered a massive heart attack. And,
oh, wow.
While I was on book tour, and I survived and didn't have to get a lawyer or anything. I just sent a note from the pre-op room that the contract just got canceled. And so by the time I got out of the hospital, my boyfriend had all the files. He'd rebuilt everything and relaunched my book. So my book is actually a self-published book, not the journey, not the smoothest journey, but it is what it is. And I'm happy and proud to own this book.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I'm responsible for my story now, wherever it is and however it is. Yeah. That's why I'm a writer on the television show as well. So how that all happened, as I was writing the book or getting ready to write the book, another producer that worked for Norman, Rachel Davidson, would hear Norman call me Sergeant. And Norman Lear, as I mentioned before, in case people aren't familiar with his work, was a pioneer television creator. He created All in the Family and the Jeffersons and Good Times and Maude and tons of movies that you know now. Obviously, Our Heart is Heavy. He produced a lot of movies with Rob Reiner and was very close with Rob and Michelle. Mm. So our hearts are breaking for their family and friends. And he would call me Sergeant, and Rachel would hear him calling me Sergeant. She thought it was just a joke, like calling a big guy tiny. And he said, no, he's actually a sergeant. So as I was writing the story, she was excited to option it. So that happened, and she optioned the book. So from the beginning, as soon as it was published, we began developing and shopping it around for television. And it wasn't until 2019, we sold it to Sony and then started developing the show during COVID. And then that's it was, you know, it's just been a rough ride. We found the fabulous Andy Parker that created the show. He adapted the book. I I urge anybody that can get access to his pilot script. It's just beautiful. You can watch it, but reading his words is just it's a cherished experience. Mm. And he's a wonderful person to work for. So we started creating and pitched it, and that's really just how it happened. It's really kind of like my experience in boot camp. I've never made this analogy, this comparison before, but I went in there just with one friend. So I think that is Rachel. With one friend, world I didn't know, and I've never sold a television series before. I've only sold movies and written on television shows. I went in with one friend, and then soon in boot camp, I got a little stronger and got a little more friends and had a platoon and had a squad and got out, and that's kind of what we had. So by the time we got ready to roll cameras, we had about 400 talented people signed on to say, let's make this crazy little Pink Marine dream come true. And, I don't know who gets this in their life. I'm absolutely overwhelmed on a daily basis that literally everybody in the world has access to Dale and my story, and that people are responding and loving it. It just makes me just completely overwhelmed is the best word. So, I wouldn't be having this conversation if I hadn't sat down and if I'd lived that experience and then written that book, and then this had all happened. So I'm really grateful for everything and everybody, because I haven't done anything alone.
Love that. Love that.
Yeah. In thinking and along this line too, the characters that were cast, I'm thinking the character Cameron, and I'm wondering how that character resonates with your experience, how closely, how distantly, and what you experienced as you watched it portrayed through another.
We decided to create that character so that, first off, we weren't making a biopic. There's many, I've got a lot of stories we could make into a television show or a movie. This is one. Mm-hmm. And so we weren't making a biopic. So we needed to give this character permission to take him places that I hadn't gone, that I wouldn't go, that I didn't go. And it also helped me in the writer's room to not be talking about myself and feeling super defensive about points in the book that I didn't want changed, which was not a hard battle to do, because everybody had fallen in love with the story and the characters as they were already. And then Andy built this beautiful cast of characters that some of them are obviously from the book, but we got to hang meat and bones around their little skeletons that I had built in the book, and talk about their hopes and dreams, and you meet all these other great characters. So the thing with Cameron is, he goes in, you want to have his want from the thing is a little different than mine. I wanted to find my place in the world. He wanted to change. He said, I don't like the way I am. I feel weak and scared, and I want to be different. So, he goes in with that directive. And then you see the progress as you've watched and as people watch, you watch and see how he tries to make that dream come true. Mm-hmm. And the book is different in the way that the character develops, because it's a lot, you see his inside voice in the show is personified. And then in the book, that inside voice is my snarky asides to the reader. I realized that only 0.1111.1% of the people knew what Marine Corps boot camp is like. I mean, Greg, you can identify with it. You had that one sad night, so I wanted to be not only very descriptive, like you mentioned, but I also wanted to be funny and wrap things in humor, which is what we did in the show too. You want those great funny breaths. So that, the main thing with Cameron is that strong want, and then the other thing, we're very similar. Yes, we're both such a rose, but it's just the idea that he was willing to identify the fact that he really wanted to change. And it's just fun to make him do all that stuff. Not totally. Yes, the stuff that I did, and then the stuff that I didn't do. I didn't beat anybody in the seventh episode.
Right. Yeah. But it was an intense moment.
Yeah.
Thanks for illustrating the arc of the character alongside the arc of your own experience.
you know, I guess if we were to compare anything, it's really just that twist towards the end. Everything else is the same. You know, we were both noticing that we were getting stronger and gaining muscle, and we, you know, caught glimpses of ourselves in the uniform and, mm-hmm. and realized, and we were aware of the change. You know, I just like Cameron, I constantly marked the changes, you know, the changes I was going through physically and appearance wise. And that was, it was fun. You know, you're putting on, again, I'd kind of put on a new character every time I changed schools, right? You get a chance to kind of reinvent yourself. So I was putting on this costume every day and acting this part, but it was real life, and I was starting to really enjoy it, and it's okay to develop new parts of your character and learn some things, you know. I my own patriotism was awakened and honed. I wasn't in touch with that as an 18-year-old. And if I hadn't have had the experience of serving and protecting our Constitution, maybe I would never have found my way into that sort of subject, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. That's interesting. Yeah, thank you for bringing that in.
Well, you know, I think that the one thing, to go back to a question earlier that I take away or that I learned, it really is that I was putting restrictions on myself, that I was perceiving that society was also placing on me. Totally. And what I learned was, I don't listen to those restrictions. Mm. If I want to do something, I get to do something. I get to try something, and I get to walk in any room that I want to. And I don't let anyone, people are welcome to define me. People are welcome not to like me. I don't care. I'm just trying to be a good person and tell a story that might help someone hang on for a day.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the show got the attention of a lot of folks, including some folks in the new Department of War. And I'm curious, you know, I read a couple of articles that talked about that was the best piece of advertising that Boots could ever get, and that the viewership went way up after that. But I'm curious about your reaction when you saw it referred to as, I'm not even going to repeat it again. When you heard the Department of War disparage the show, what was your reaction?
I never realized they were obsessed with me. They spelled my name right. My book was the title of my book. Pink Marine is not an unfamiliar phrase anymore, and I realized that they probably didn't watch the show, because what we have in the show, just like the experience that I show in the book, my book and the show are both well known as love letters to the Marine Corps. If you look at my Kirkus review, it even says, you know, he gives a surprisingly reverent view of military service. I'm like, because there are good parts of it. I took the good from it. I took the you know, the honor, courage, and commitment that the Marine Corps says. There is a promise that the Marine Corps gave me in exchange for protecting the Constitution. They told me that they would give me the ability to do anything that I wanted to do, and I ran with that.
Love it.
I love this statement that they were, I didn't know that they were obsessed with me. But I would say that they are obsessed with sexuality, period. And look, as it surfaces with gender, too. Go ahead. I have a question about that, but I want to hear what you have to say.
Look at our characters in the show. Look at the cast and think about their journeys and their hopes and dreams. You've got the great Kieran Moore playing Slovacek, who is just trying to make a better life for himself. He chose boot camp over prison, and he is devastated when that is almost taken away from him. And I hope people are really holding onto that character and understanding what a powerful transformation that is. You look at John Bowman, that lost 100 pounds during production. In the book, he only lost 50 pounds. And I was astounded when he came back and earned his way back in the platoon. So, you know, John Bowman and you know, Andy created this brother Cody for him, gave him that great tension of having the brothers in there at the same time, which is actually a popular thing to go in with a relative. And the you know, my bunkie with the obsession of his wife and all of that stuff, everybody had a different reason for joining. And I think that's why I believe that anyone that instantly wants to criticize the show because they think it's just about one gay character hasn't given it a chance, because it's not. It's really about It's about who gets to be an American. It's a microcosm of our whole society.
Absolutely. And like, even like, I think of it in a way that there's an aspect that it's a caricature too of masculinity. You know, what's coming to mind is Tom of Finland drawings in the sense like man drag. And I was like, the question I had about how this relates to the present experience, the vicious attacks on trans people being in the military, and just curious from your perspective, having an insider view, like what you think about that and what needs to be done to help turn things around.
I honestly believe that, I mean, look, we're an all-volunteer military. We ask young people from all walks of life, and everybody is on a different place in the spectrum, whatever that is. And if they want to serve their country, protect our Constitution, and be willing to lay down their life to fight that battle, and they're qualified to serve, they should be welcome to serve and embraced and celebrated for their sacrifice. I have met so many trans veterans and people currently in that are obviously devastated and feel so unseen. And so any light that is shined on the subject from our show, I hope is spreading out to that community as well. It's mm-hmm. it's, you know, the one of the most common characteristics in the trans community is military service. And mm-hmm. and you're saying someone that is passionate about defending our country is not welcome to do that? No, ma'am, sit down. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very complex, very, very, very complex terrain to like try to talk about and navigate the way the intersection of like military, but also with our gender norms and like what we're expecting of people in society. And it's just baffling to me that there's this misunderstanding even of how gender is working. You know, it's like as if these men who are beefing up their bodies and wearing these uniforms and speaking gruffly have not also the spectrum underneath of the transgender edge and the experience that we're like making all that up in many, many ways too, even if one is cisgender. So I just think it's really like a complex situation, and there's so much investment in like shoring up and kind of a pretending around masculinity. And I think that that's, you know, featured in the film in a way that we can really witness in a very tangible way.
You know, I think there's obviously extra, you're in a fishbowl, so there's obviously extra pressure to be perceived in a way that you're accepted by the group, right? You're in this small room, and you know, Lazo, you see Ochoa in the show is so singled out, and so he does a lot of that to himself, takes him out of the picture a lot, you know, and it's because he's so obsessed. But it's the last thing you want is to be in that pressure cooker and not be regarded well. So yeah, I think you do, you put on whatever you can to get through the day, but it's, you're all after the same goal, you're there for the same job, and you know, everybody's just there to do their job. That's as deep as it gets.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, the series is available.
Do you have my back? Do I have your back? End of story.
Totally.
Well, the series is available to stream on Netflix. If you haven't seen it, I definitely recommend taking some time over this holiday season to sit down and enjoy it. Greg, where can people go to follow you and learn more about the book?
I have a website, thepinkmarine.com. My book is available everywhere books are. I narrate the audiobook. I'm working on a second book. I'm hoping to have it out this spring. It picks up where this book ends off with my first day at my first duty station in the regular Marine Corps. I also went to officer candidate school, so I share a lot about that perspective as well. It's just boot camp all over again. And my socials are Eat Greg Eat. It's
again, Eat Greg Eat?
Eat Greg Eat. It's back
on
that,
Instagram. I'm going to go there now.
The food thing.
I love it. And we'll put.
And you know what? I just want to say thank you both, like I said at the beginning, but also I want to thank everybody that spends any time with my story, whether it's in my book or the show. Time is precious, and those hours that you spend with that, I am it's unbelievable that it's out there and that's something that people can do. And so I'm just so thankful for people that spend a minute with that and for this conversation.
So lovely. Great to have you. Yeah, thank you.
And we'll put links to all of those ways to check out your work on our own website at outbeatnews.com. You can just click on show notes at the top of the page. The book is called The Pink Marine, and we've been talking with its author, Greg Copewhite. Greg, thanks so much for spending Sunday night with us.
Thank you. Thank you. Have a great rest of your evening.
Bye, Greg.
Wow. What a story, huh?
Yeah, super cool. I have not often had the opportunity or maybe even ever to talk with an author who has a story in book form, also in a TV form, and to hear the background story was really, really enjoyable for me.
Yeah.
Energizing.
Well, I hope that second book comes out and that maybe a Netflix or somebody else picks it up and we see maybe another season of the story.
I was bummed that they're not going to, that we heard that they're not going to be doing a second.
I was as well. I think it's a really missed opportunity for Netflix or anybody else, because this right now, this story is contemporary to what's going on in the military.
100%. Yeah.
You know, as you pointed out there towards the end. Hey, it's our last show of the year. I love the fact that you're part of our team and that we're working together. I love what you bring to it. And I'm just so excited about what we're going to be doing in 2026.
Thank you, Greg. Yeah, I really appreciate it. I enjoy it. And it's also been a fun developmental arc for me, too, to be working on this show. And I love talking to people. I really love networking and talking with people who are doing something. So it's been fun to reach out and have conversations with people. And I'm really excited about that for next year. I want to make a big list and just start reaching out to tons of people.
Fantastic. Well, Happy New Year.
Yeah, Happy New Year.
And that wraps up our hour and the last show for 2025. But before we go, I want to extend a special thank you to our news partners, especially The Advocate Magazine, LGBTQ Nation, and of course, The Bay Area Reporter. Thank you for all you do all year long to keep our news and our community visible. And to all of you, our loyal listeners, we wish you a very happy new year, and thanks for spending your Sunday night with us. Outbeat News in Depth is hosted and produced by Greg Moralia. Our shows are available for on-demand play anytime on our website at outbeatnews.com and on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, TuneIn, and now on iHeartRadio. Find links to subscribe at outbeatnews.com. I'd love to change the world, but I don't know what. So I give it up to you. You're broken down and tired of living life on the merry-go-round, and you can't find a fighter. But I see it in you, so we gon' walk it out. Move mountains. We gon' walk it out and move mountains. And I'll rise up. I'll rise. Support for Outbeat Radio on KRCBFM comes from listeners and from Rocky, the free-range chicken, and Rosie, the original organic chicken. Air-chilled, non-GMO, locally raised right here in Sonoma County with no antibiotics ever. More information is available at rockyandrosie.com. You're listening to 104.9 KRCB-FM Rohnert Park and KRCG-FM Windsor, Sonoma County's NPR station. It's 9 p.m. Stay with us. Le Jazz Hot is next.